People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions.
Hello, I'm Chris Nicklin with this week's People of Note. Sir Nicholas Stadlin is an eminent British legal man. He's a former High Court judge who sprang to prominence as a barrister when he made the longest ever speech in court, lasting an astonishing 119 days. Nick, as he prefers to be called, had prepared well for that. While a student at Cambridge University, he was president of the Cambridge Union, the oldest continuously running debating society in the world. In retirement, he's turned his hand to documentary filmmaking, and he's in Cape Town for the screening of his directorial debut, Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes, at the Encounters Film Festival. Nick, out of sheer, possibly morbid curiosity, what was it like being on your feet in court presenting an argument lasting a marathon 119 days?
Well, it wasn't as bad for me as it was for the poor judge, because at least I got to talk for 119 days. Imagine the poor judge, he had to sit there and listen to it all.
I bet, presumably, your voice held up all that time.
My voice did. My feet didn't. After a few weeks, my feet started hurting, and I was sent to a podiatrist, a speciality of whose existence I'd previously been unaware, and she said, if God had intended us to stand on our feet talking for 6 hours a day, he would have given us wider feet. So she said, you're going to have to take your shoes off for the rest of the speech.
Good grief. The judge wasn't willing to let you sit down.
He did, in fact, not do that, but he did say halfway through that we were going to take off wigs and robes, and that, in fact, was a trial, which we only discovered later, run for abolishing wigs and gowns, which happened a few years later.
Oh, really? So was this a classic example of trying to wear down your enemy by speaking for that long?
It wasn't, actually, no. It was just that there was so much material.
What was the case?
I was defending the Bank of England, who had supervised Bank of Commerce and Credit International, BCCI, and the liquidators brought a claim against the Bank of England alleging that they had dishonestly failed to close it down, knowing that it was going to collapse. And that claim failed, and after 2 years, the claim was withdrawn.
I recall it became, the case became quite a cause célèbre in the end. Now, your film Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes, is ostensibly about the Rivonia trial, which led to Nelson Mandela's lifetime incarceration. But it's much, much more than that, isn't it?
It is indeed. And the reason it's called Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes, Life is Wonderful is a reference to Dennis Goldberg.
Accused number three in the trial.
Accused number three. And when the judge, Mr. Justice DeVette, announced his sentence, he spoke in a very quiet voice. And Dennis Goldberg's mother, Annie, at the back of the court, couldn't hear what he said. And everyone was expecting a death sentence. So she shouted out, Dennis, Dennis, what is it? And Dennis turned to the public gallery, his face wreathed in smiles, and said, it's life, and life is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And why unsung heroes? Because everybody in the world knows and admires Nelson Mandela, probably the most admired statesman of the 20th century.
Yes.
Very few people know that there were other people, some of them extraordinary like him, others ordinary people, but who also displayed immense courage and self-sacrifice.
And in their own way became quite extraordinary people.
Indeed. And that's what my film is about. It's just to show people that it isn't only people who are born great who can change the world. It is ordinary people who have depths of courage and resolve who can change the world.
You have no obvious links with South Africa and our political morass here. Do you think your legal background played a role in steering you towards making this particular film, which embodies one of South Africa's most iconic political stories?
I don't think it is, actually. I mean, there are some very interesting aspects of the trial, and it gives rise to some important legal issues about the rule of law. But what really drew me to it was just the bravery and self-sacrifice of these people. And it was the politics and the human depths of courage that drew me to the story.
In the opening of the film, which you narrate, you describe the Rivonia trial as the most remarkable in legal history. Do you mean the most remarkable in international terms?
I do. There's an extraordinary coincidence that the two, I think, most important political speeches of the 20th century, one was Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, August 1963, and the other was Nelson Mandela's speech in the Rivonia trial, where he ended famously by saying that a free and fair democracy open to all was one for which, if needs be, he was prepared to die. They were speeches made within 8 months of each other. Martin Luther King's speech ultimately led to the disintegration of segregation in the South of the United States, and Mandela's speech led, a long time later, to the peaceful transition from apartheid to a free democracy based on universal and multiracial suffrage.
It's been suggested that the Rivonia trial was in fact the actual end of apartheid. Do you agree with that?
No, it was the beginning of the end.
In what way, Nick?
In the sense that by making the decision to turn the trial from a legal trial into a political trial, putting apartheid in the dock of world opinion and garnering support among the ANC supporters in South Africa, because the ANC were not allowed to be reported, but because it was a court trial, the newspapers were allowed to and did every day report what was said. And Mandela's famous three-hour speech was a brilliant statement of the appalling unfairness and humiliation and degradation and injustice of apartheid. And that his name, coupled with the fact that he then spent 27 years in prison, made him an icon all around the world, which ultimately led to the campaign to release him. But beyond that, why it changed the history of South Africa is that he opened the way in his closing speech to the Rainbow Coalition and the extending the olive branch to the whites and the Afrikaners. And what is, I think, not very well known is that that was not something that happened as a result of a transformation he underwent in prison.
Mm-hmm.
That transformation he underwent between 1948, when he was elected to the National Executive Committee of the ANC Youth League with Walter Sisulu and Oliver Tambo, and the Rivonia trial. And what changed him, in my view, was his observation and experience of a number of white and Indians, lawyers and political activists.
People like Dennis Goldberg, who you referred to a short while ago.
People like Dennis Goldberg, people in particular like Bram Fischer,
mm-hmm.
who was the extraordinary leader of the defense team, the QC, who saved them from the gallows, but who was also, as well as being chairman of Johannesburg Bar Council, chairman of the banned South African Communist Party. And Nelson Mandela, subsequently, in a Bram Fischer lecture, said that Bram was braver than the rest of them because he and his colleagues were able to rely on the support of their own people for whom they were fighting. But Bram was fighting for the freedom of others and had to put up with the ostracism of his own Afrikaner people.
We'll chat about Bram Fischer a little more. But time for your first musical choice, Nick. What is it?
It's the Schubert Octet. And I've chosen it because when I was 17 and revising for my Latin and Greek A-levels, I went to stay with my uncle in Salisbury, and they had the Schubert Octet on a long-playing record, and it was so exciting and full of life and enthusiasm, and it just seemed to me to reflect all the possibilities of life.
Here it is, then. That was Franz Schubert's Octet in F major, chosen by this week's guest on People of Note, Nick Stadlin. Nick, before we get on to your efforts as a filmmaker, I'm sure listeners will be interested in your background. Your father, Peter Stadlin, was a composer and distinguished concert pianist, and your mother, Hedy Stadlin, made her name as a political activist in what was then known as Ceylon, of all places. But she also shared your father's passion for music, didn't she?
She didn't, actually.
Oh.
She was tone deaf. And one of the extraordinary things about their...
But they collaborated at least.
They did indeed. And that is the extraordinary thing about their very close and loving relationship, was that having been a political activist and also a philosopher, she got the only first-class degree at Cambridge in philosophy under Wittgenstein. She then chose to put all that aside after she came back from Ceylon, and spent three very happy decades working with my father when he became a music critic.
Both were Austrian Jews who fled their home country after the Anschluss, didn't they?
My father actually had gone back to Austria to vote in the referendum on whether there should be a merger between Austria and Germany, having given a concert tour in Ireland. And he chatted up an American girl on the ferry on the top deck, caught a cold, and was stuck in Amsterdam for a few days, missed the Anschluss by a day, turned around and came back to England.
Mm-hmm. And your mother, I believe?
My mother had experienced anti-Semitism at Vienna University, and her father was able to get her into Newnham College, Cambridge, which was the great changing experience of her life, because she was for the first time welcomed for who she was and not for what race she was.
Mm. And I believe you can trace your family links directly to the Austrian composer Johann Strauss.
Yes, my...
Interesting.
My grandfather, my mother's father, was the godson and son-in-law of Johann Strauss. Mm-hmm. And we have at home a small waltz composed by Johann Strauss, which is inscribed, it's in hand, inscribed to Jani, who he used to babysit.
I believe that your father had what can only be described as an obsession with Beethoven, and came a world authority on the somewhat controversial subject of Beethoven's metronome markings. What's that all about?
Well, he was a concert pianist and then became a musicologist and a music critic. And he spent a year as a visiting fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. He started doing research on Beethoven and the metronome marks. But when he went to East Berlin, before the wall came down, as he was doing the research, he discovered that there had been a forgery in the Schindler notebooks. Mm-hmm. And so he brought photocopies of these forgeries out. But because the...
Schindler was Beethoven's secretary or something.
He took down, he recorded, when Beethoven was deaf, he recorded all the conversations. And so my father smuggled these photocopies out. And in order to avoid the detection of the authorities in the museum, he had to photocopy lots more pages of completely irrelevant things so as not to draw attention to the gold that he had found.
Mm-hmm. But what about the metronome? I believe your father actually tracked down Beethoven's metronome at some point.
Yes, he did. He had an extraordinary collection of metronomes, and he was indeed very preoccupied with getting exactly right what Beethoven intended with his music.
How did he find Beethoven's metronome?
Through very diligent and patient research.
Mm-hmm. And I heard that although he tracked down the metronome, the weight was missing.
Yes, I don't know.
The puzzle remained, in a sense.
I'm not sure. All I remember as a child was that there were a lot of metronomes tick-tocking away in the music room.
How about another music break, Nick? What's your second choice?
It's Pete Seeger singing We Shall Overcome. And I've chosen it because it reminds me of a very exciting year of my life when I was in America in 1968. I'd been there on an English Speaking Union scholarship to a school, but I ran away, got a job as a busboy in a restaurant, the Tavern in the Green, and I came home one night to hear on the news that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And I got on a Greyhound bus and went down to Memphis and from there to Atlanta and spent some time volunteering in the Poor People's Campaign, which he had been leading when he was shot, and then ended up as a volunteer on the Eugene McCarthy presidential campaign in California. And the song just was the anthem for young people in those exciting 1968 days who wanted change.
Mm. So your mother's political activism did rub off onto you after all?
Well, whether it was her or whether it was me, I suppose a psychoanalyst probably could tell. I don't know.
Well, here's Pete Seeger with We Shall Overcome.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
Montgomery, Alabama. They said, "We are not afraid." And the young people taught everybody else a lesson. All the older people that had learned how to compromise and learned how to take it easy and be polite and get along and leave things as they were. The young people taught us all a lesson.
We are not afraid.
Pete Seeger with We Shall Overcome. It's the choice of our guest on People of Note, Sir Nicholas Stadlin, director of the film Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes, being screened at the Encounters Film Festival here in Cape Town. Nick, your film is constructed around the people who were on Mandela's side in the Rivonia trial, his co-accused and the defense lawyers. What do you think you've managed to reveal about them?
I think a number of things. The most important is their immense courage and self-sacrifice. And it, of course, everyone knows about Nelson Mandela, but everybody has only one neck, and they all risked their necks.
Mm-hmm.
By way of example, Dennis Goldberg, at the beginning, when they were told by their lawyers that they would probably hang, quite spontaneously offered to pretend that he had exceeded his mandate when he went to order munitions in order to save the leadership. Kathy Kathrada and Raymond Mushlaba were advised that they had very good prospects of appeal against conviction and sentence, and they declined. And when I interviewed Kathy before he died, mm-hmm. he said there were two reasons. One was personal, because he didn't want to break ranks with his comrades, and the other was political. He, as an Indian, had spoken in the black townships for the ANC, and he didn't want people to think that he was prepared to talk the talk, but not walk the walk. And both of them spent 26 years in prison that they probably need not have spent.
Mm, that's astonishing to think. It's more than half a century since the Rivonia trial, yet some of the main protagonists in your film, like the indefatigable Dennis Goldberg, who we've been talking about, still managed to tell the story with an extraordinary dedication mixed with humour and some obvious pain.
One of the remarkable things about the Rivonia trial was that although they were all on trial for their lives and expected to be hanged, there were frequent moments of great hilarity and humour. And it was so humbling in my interviews with Dennis and Andrew Mulangeni and Cathy Cathrada, the three surviving defendants at that time, was that they remained completely committed to their cause, and they lived in very modest circumstances. We've heard a lot about swimming pools and so on, but they lived and continue to live, in the case of Dennis and Andrew, in very modest circumstances, and they are people of real integrity. And it is that integrity which I think it's really important that particularly the younger generation should learn about, because it's very inspiring at what is a pivotal time now in the history of South Africa.
Yes. People like Dennis Goldberg were prone to wisecrack all the time, and the defense lawyers were concerned that the accused seemed quite defiant in spite of a looming death penalty. What do you think was behind their apparent bravado?
Dennis just is irrepressible. He's no different now to what everyone describes him as then. He's full of joie de vivre. Life is wonderful.
But just going back to this point about the lawyers' concern about their bravado, do you think that they risked jeopardizing their trial because of their attitude?
Well, it was actually not all of them. It was just, I think, particularly Dennis. And Vernon Beranger, who was in charge of leading his evidence, was severe with Dennis and reprimanded him and said, you're not to joke around when you're in the witness box.
The defense team's senior counsel, Bram Fischer, who we've spoken about already, and who was leading an astonishing double life himself at the time of the Rivonia trial, outwitted the prosecution by showing that the accused were really only discussing plans for guerrilla war rather than having actually launched a campaign. How much of a legal masterstroke was this?
It was absolutely essential. It was what saved their lives. If the judge had not been persuaded that the Operation Mayabuye blueprint for guerrilla warfare had not been approved, he would have had no choice but to sentence them to death. And he might still have sentenced them to death, even though he was persuaded by Bram Fischer that they had not approved the plan. But the fact that he did persuade him opened the door for him to pass life sentences instead. And Bram Fischer is, to my mind, a person without historic parallel, in that he risked his own life for not his own people, but for other people. And it was a point made by Nelson Mandela when he delivered the first Bram Fischer memorial lecture, that he, Mandela, had always been able to draw strength from the fact that he had the support of his own people and was fighting for the freedom of his people. But Bram, he said, was already a free man, and he had to put up with the ostracism of his own Africana people because he was fighting for the freedom of the black and Indian population.
In a way, Bram Fischer becomes the standout story in your film. Was that intentional?
It was. I think there were three people who really stood out in the trial. Nelson Mandela, of course, first and foremost, because of his speech. Walter Sisulu, because of his fantastic six-day cross-examination by Percy Utah, in which he wiped the floor with him, even though he had only a few years' education and Utah was the only PhD in the government legal service.
But Bram Fischer's story was quite tragic in the end.
Bram Fischer was a true hero. He turned his back on what could have been being elected Prime Minister or appointed Chief Justice. He came from an elite Afrikaner nationalist family and was himself elected an Afrikaner nationalist Prime Minister at a student parliament. But he had a Road to Damascus moment where he felt revulsion shaking hands with a black man when he was in his early 20s. And he went home and tossed and turned and remembered that growing up on the farm, his two best friends were the black children of farm labourers, and realised that he had changed, not them, and he had been subjected to effectively indoctrination growing up in Bloemfontein. And he went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, went to the Soviet Union on a visit, and he came back a communist. He was a remarkable man. Rusty Bernstein, one of the accused, when he heard that Bram Fischer was accepting the defence brief, said he should be given the Victoria Cross because many of the prosecution witnesses were farm labourers at the Liddesleaf safe house where most of them were arrested, And Brahm had been there the week before, and he could easily have been recognized.
Mm. How do you think Brahm Fischer coped with the sort of life he was leading? On the one hand, this establishment legal figure, and on the other hand, this underground existence as chairman of the Communist Party at the time.
It was an extraordinary Jekyll and Hyde existence. He was one of the most sought-after QCs in Johannesburg. He ended up being chairman of the banned South African Communist Party. And one of the interesting things about the story and about the film is the way in which he grappled with the issue of the rule of law. He and Nelson Mandela were both passionately committed to the rule of law. When he went underground, jumping his bail, Brahm Fischer, when he was arrested after the trial for being a communist, when he decided to, as an act of defiance, go underground as the Scarlet Pimpernel to Mandela's Black Pimpernel, mm-hmm. when he went underground, he ensured that he was in credit with the taxman. He believed in obeying the law, but not laws that were immoral and were oppressive and were passed by a parliament that was not elected on a universal franchise. And he had a very clear distinction in his mind between those two things.
And there's that devastating moment in the film after the Rivonia trial where Brahm Fischer heads off in his car with his wife down to Cape Town to visit the prisoners on Robben Island to try to persuade them to appeal against the sentence. He's involved in an accident and his wife Molly was killed.
It was an absolute tragedy. And one of the most extraordinary acts of bravery on his part and self-sacrifice is that when he afterwards went to London and was, to everyone's surprise, granted bail to argue a case in the Privy Council and was begged by the exile comrades to stay in London, he went back and to face trial. He then decided to go underground in the middle of his trial because they had introduced the so-called Sobukwe Clause, in which he could have been subjected to indefinite detention without access to the courts. And by doing that, he knew that when he was finally caught, which took 9 months and would inevitably happen, they'd throw the book at him, as they did. And he had a son who was suffering from a degenerative disease.
Yes.
And he effectively knew that he was going to leave his son without either a father or a mother. And it was devastating for him.
And one of the scoops in your film is an interview with the passenger who was in the car with Brahm Fischer and his wife when they crashed.
Yes, Liz Franklin.
An anti-apartheid activist herself.
Yes, she had been working for, I think, the Callan Collins Legal Aid Trust and was in the car. And it was, of course, utterly devastating for her and utterly devastating for Brahm.
Time for some more music, Nick. What's your third track, please?
The next track is The Prisoners from Fidelio. I'd chosen it because I heard it for the first time when I was in my mid-20s and I'd gone from court and my head was full of my case. And suddenly I was just picked up by the collar and shaken. And it was the first time I'd had the experience of a musical tour de force that just took you right out of yourself. And it's such a wonderful evocation of the horrors of being unfairly in prison and the glory of freedom.
Thank you.
The Prisoner's Chorus from Beethoven's Fidelio, chosen by Nick Stadlin, director of the film Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes, currently showing at the Encounters Documentary Festival. Nick, I read somewhere that you described filming the documentary in South Africa as the most exciting month of your life. What happened to make it such a memorable experience?
It was extraordinary. First of all, I'd never done anything like it at all. I'd been a judge. Mm-hmm. And I ended up sort of schlepping the tripods for the camera all around Cape Town and Johannesburg.
Like all good directors do.
Well, I wouldn't know. I've never directed anything. But why it was so exciting was that I met so many people who were incredibly inspiring and are incredibly inspiring. People who 50 years ago risked their lives, risked torture, suffered torture, in many cases gave up a quarter of a century in prison. And we're still living in modest circumstances. Andrew, Dennis and Kathy, heroic people who have never taken advantage either of their fame or of their historic role in the freedom of South Africa. And it was a humbling and very privileged experience to have got to know these people and to tell their stories.
For obvious reasons, much of your film is located in the Palace of Justice in Pretoria, where the Rivonia trial was heard. And it was here that Nelson Mandela made that famous statement from the dock that we were talking about a little earlier. It was quite a gamble that he chose to make a statement rather than subject himself to cross-examination, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't a gamble. It was effectively writing his own death warrant.
How serious is that?
Well, because they had been advised by the lawyers that if he made a statement from the dock, it would carry less weight than if he subjected himself to cross-examination, and therefore the prospect of being hanged was greater. But he was adamant that the only priority was to be able to make an uninterrupted political speech in which the prosecutor, Percy Utah, couldn't interrupt him, and that was going to put apartheid in the dock. And as Joel Joffe said, their attorney,
One of the lawyers.
He couldn't bear the idea of these people of immense integrity being hanged. But Mandela insisted, and all the defendants insisted. And the only compromise Mandela was prepared to make was to include the words, if needs be, which he was persuaded to introduce by George Bizos. George Bizos told him the story of Socrates, who had a sizable minority against his conviction, who were turned against him when, as he was entitled to do, he nominated as his punishment that he should be kept in the style of Olympic athlete for the rest of his days, and so he was put to death. That, said George, is not a good omen.
And although, as you say, Mandela's concluding remarks were toned down by one of the lawyers, George Bizos, it was nonetheless quite a taunting remark made directly to the judge, wasn't it?
As Dennis Gelberg says in the film, it was a direct challenge to the judge and to the whole of white South Africa, hang us if you dare. And one of the remarkable things about it is that this was not hypothetical or academic. Every week during the trial, prisoners were hanged on the same day at 6 o'clock in the morning, and the night before the whole prison sang in solidarity until the trapdoor fell. So for these defendants, death was something that they were living with every day for months.
I think in the film you described Mandela's statement from the dock as the most famous rallying cry in legal history. Is that how you see it?
I do, because it was not only putting apartheid in the dock, it was making the point, I have fought against white domination all my life, I have fought against black domination all my life. He was saying that he was opening the door to a multiracial, non-racial South Africa. And in the words of Andrew Mulungeni, who I filmed getting an honorary doctorate in the University of South Africa, we were a multiracial band of comrades fighting for a multiracial democracy.
Nick, with your legal expertise in mind, was it a surprise that the Rivonia trialists didn't get the death penalty, given the severity of charges they were facing?
Yes, Percy Utah shamelessly subsequently announced when he was invited by Nelson Mandela to tea when he was president that he was responsible for saving them from the gallows by only charging them with sabotage conspiracy rather than treason conspiracy. That's nonsense. Both charges carried the death penalty, and conspiracy was helpful to the prosecution because it required a lower burden of proof and didn't require a preliminary examination which would have tipped off the defendants. Nobody knew what the sentence was going to be. Most people expected the death sentence. There are some indications that the judge had said the day before. The British consul spoke to one of the defence lawyers and said there will be no hangings and there will be one acquittal. So there had been some contact between the court and the outside world. Mm-hmm. But everybody thought that there was a risk of the death sentence. And until he uttered the words, nobody knew which way it would go.
Right, time for your fourth and final musical track, Nick. What is it?
My final track is from Gluck's Orfeo and Eurydice. And I've chosen it because it's sung by Kathleen Ferrier, and my father accompanied her in the Wigmore Hall in 1948, and in the Wigmore Hall there is a poster of the two of them, but also because it was played at my mother's funeral, and it is heart-rendingly beautiful, and it's ultimately about love and about losing the person that you love. And it reminds me of the very close and loving relationship between my parents.
Oh,
Kathleen Ferrier singing Che Farà Senza from Christoph Gluck's opera Orfeo and Eurydice, chosen by Nick Stadlin, director of the film Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes. Nick, in a very poignant moment at the end of your film, Andrew Mlangeni, who was accused number 10, laments that the generation of today doesn't really know how much they suffered, and that to see what is happening in latter-day South Africa makes his heart bleed. What sort of impact do you hope your film will have?
I very much hope that my film will act as an inspiration, particularly to the younger generation, to whom these names and these extraordinary stories may be unknown. South Africa is a country rich in natural assets, but its greatest asset is the existence of these heroic figures who risked everything, suffered enormously, made enormous sacrifices for the freedom of their fellow countrymen and countrywomen. This is a pivotal moment in the history of South Africa with the election of a new president who was very active in the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s and who has planted his flag firmly in the soil of going back to the values of Nelson Mandela of decency and integrity. And I hope that by showing to young people, particularly in South Africa, the heights of courage and commitment of these extraordinary but also ordinary people, that the younger generation may be inspired to ask themselves, well, if these people could make those sacrifices for their country and for their fellow man, what can I do to change the world?
Yes, it's quite sad how quickly their contribution can be forgotten.
That's why I think history is so important, and that's why I've made this film. These are remarkable stories of remarkable people, and I've yet to encounter somebody who is not moved by the sheer human heights to which these people were able to soar. And I hope that that may make a small contribution to inspiring young people to think that actually noble was achieved by noble people, and it is a baton that can be passed on to them in order to continue the hard work of which there is plainly a great deal still to do.
Was it your intention, in a way, to compare the deeply principled Rivonia trialists and their lawyers with some of the dubious characters who occupy the highest political offices in contemporary South Africa?
I think the stories speak for themselves. They were people who had no motive of personal advancement. And as I've said, the three surviving defendants, when I interviewed them, all lived in very modest circumstances. Mm-hmm. Andrew Mlangeni was the chairman of the ANC Ethics Commission. Dennis Goldberg travelled the world, giving all his fees from his speeches to two charities that he supports for ordinary people here in South Africa. And that is the message that I think should be widely known among young South Africans who never experienced apartheid. They may know intellectually, but they may be more difficult for them to engage emotionally with just how awful apartheid was and just what an extraordinary achievement it was to bring it to an end.
Nick, after Encounters, your film is going to be screened on Mnet and at a number of pretty auspicious events in the UK. Where exactly?
Well, there's going to be a UK launch at the British Museum on the 20th of July with an introduction by Sir Sidney Kentridge, who defended Bram Fischer at his trial.
I was going to say, the venerable Sir Sidney Kentridge, who I can't believe is still going strong in his mid-90s, and he was involved in almost every major political trial in South Africa in the latter half of the 20th century.
Indeed he was. He was played a pivotal role in the treason trial, demolishing the prosecution case. He defended Bram Fischer at his trial. He was going to be engaged by Bob Heppel's father at the Rivonia trial to act for him, but Bob Heppel in the end escaped to England.
So Sidney Kentridge will be introducing your film at the British Museum.
Yes, and then it will be screening at the Curzon Cinema. It will be shown at the South African High Commission, and it will be shown as part of the Mandela Centenary celebrations at the South Bank Centre in the Wigmore Hall.
How do you think it'll go down with British audiences?
Well, I hope that, like me, who knew nothing about these stories, people who watch and listen will be moved and impressed and inspired to themselves to aspire to the kind of approach to life that these very brave men and women are a symbol of.
And finally, Nick, to what extent did you personally identify with the Rivonia trialists and their lawyers, given your own family history, because many of them were from families that had fled persecution or were experiencing oppression firsthand themselves.
Ever since I was 10, when I saw on Panorama on the BBC programs about segregation in the Deep South and apartheid in South Africa, I thought that racial discrimination is the worst form of injustice. And so, yes, I did empathize with the Rivonia trialists, and not just them, but all the people who were involved in that struggle. I was not ever in a position where I was called upon to make the kind of really difficult decisions, moral decisions, that they were.
So Nick Stadlin, director of Life is Wonderful, Mandela's Unsung Heroes, thank you for joining us on People of Note.
Thank you very much.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This December, something extraordinary is coming to Cape Town. Experience the global phenomenon Matilda the Musical, inspired by the magic of Roald Dahl, live on stage at Artscape. The New York Post says, believe the hype. Don't miss the musical of the decade, proudly brought to you by Peter Turin and GWB Entertainment in association with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Be a genius. Book now. FMR.